Suncast is proudly supported by Trina Solar.
In the developed world, we take so much for granted. And a lot of that comes from appliances and consuming power. So for instance, if you ask somebody like yourself, what's your favorite appliance? You might say your smartphone or your one-wheel scooter or something. But in fact, when you're deprived of it, you realize that the most important appliances are the basic ones. Right. It's refrigerators, it's flush toilets, it's running water, and that those are far more important.
Whoever can make an affordable, rugged, and high-performance freezer has a billion-dollar market ahead of them. So the opportunity to make a better product in this segment, I do think there would be huge financial reward for whoever can crack it. And I think we have a huge head start because we've already done 2 years of R&D and already launched it.
Hey there, Solar Warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in and welcome to our tribe. Hey there, Solar Warrior. Welcome back. If you are new here, welcome in and thank you for giving us the only non-renewable resource you've got. Of course, that is your time. Thanks for lending us your ears as well. I promise you're going to be well compensated for the investment today. Yeah, I recently traveled all the way out to Redwood City, California to learn about how two intrepid entrepreneurs are solving energy problems halfway around the world in Africa. Amped Innovation is a designer and manufacturer of high-performance off-grid solar systems and appliances for solar-rich environments. And they've served hundreds of thousands of families and businesses in need of reliable, clean electricity all across Africa and Asia. I'm joined today by the two co-founders of Amped, Andy Kleissner and Kurt Coleman. They've dedicated practically their entire careers to product innovation and social enterprise. Today, we dig deep on why they've focused particularly on the social impact element of the work they do and why, specifically, they chose Africa as the vehicle for what Andy refers to as wealth delivery and value creation. Hey, if you're new here to Suncast, we dig in each and every week with entrepreneurs on the front lines of the clean energy transition so that we can help you build your business and career, find your community and meaning in your work, and leave an enduring legacy. I hope that you'll subscribe to the show because that'll ensure that you won't miss out on the more than 700 episodes just like this that you can explore at mysuncast.com. Entrepreneurs who are changing the way folks interact with electrons and the devices that manage them. And yes, also helping lift folks up out of poverty, as you'll hear today. For now, let's get ready to tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, as we tune into another powerful conversation here on Suncast. Well, it's so exciting for me to have a chance to be in person in the office for Amped Innovation. Hat tip to my friend Lauren Burke, who is the chief marketing officer here at Amped Innovation and also a return Peace Corps volunteer, as I am. She reached out and said, you've got to meet these folks that I'm working with. They're doing tremendous work. And when I dug deeper, in fact, I was quite impressed, not just with the business, but with the people that have created it. Andy and Kurt, I'm really excited to have this conversation today. Thanks for welcoming us into your office.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Thanks for coming over.
So, Kurt, it was funny. I don't think you knew that I'm a fellow quote collector. So I kind of kick off every episode with quotes. And it's interesting because in person, I don't always include the quotes. It's a lot easier through the virtual interview process. I'm going to read one since we're in California. Arnold Schwarzenegger said, develop your strengths when you go through hardships and decide not to surrender. That is strength. And having worked as a Peace Corps volunteer in Latin America, I got to see more than my fair share of hardship. Folks that when I was growing up, I didn't really appreciate, as many of us now know, sort of in the developing nations, just how challenging it is to have light to read by.
And how much you take for granted.
And how much we take for granted here in America, right? Things like running water and electricity and even a latrine inside of your home are very first world modern comforts that were afforded. So I wanted to start with that quote. I think it's sort of fitting for the conversation that we're going to unpack. Kurt, you shared a quote with me that is a really remarkable one. I had not heard it before. Would you share that again?
Compassion is more important than wisdom, and understanding that is the beginning of wisdom.
Mm.
You like that one?
I do like that one. So compassion is the beginning of wisdom and understanding.
But understanding that, compassion is more important than wisdom, but understanding that is the beginning of wisdom.
That's really cool. I like that. There's a lot of compassion that goes into the work that you guys
definitely
are engaged in. Yeah. When you are in communities around the Silicon Valley area, when you're at maybe a dinner with your husband or your significant other, how do you describe generally the problem that you're trying to solve in the world?
I would say that in the developed world, we take so much for granted for what constitutes our standard of living. And a lot of that comes from appliances and consuming power in creative ways. So for instance, if you ask somebody like yourself, what's your favorite appliance? You might say your smartphone or your one-wheel scooter or something. But in fact, when you're deprived of it, you realize that the most important appliances are the basic ones.
Right.
It's refrigerators, it's flush toilets,
mm-hmm.
it's running water, and that those are far more important than counting steps with your smartphone and whatnot.
Yeah. I often just say, imagine being without internet for 2 hours, and people are like, what?
Now make that be without electricity and heating and, you know, and water. And right.
Let alone some of friends and family who, when they do travel and go a little bit out of their comfort zone, they're so happy to come back and they've only been there for a week. So,
yeah, having traveled to these places, you come back, and I'm sure this was your experience, you come back feeling quite spoiled.
Yes.
You know, and you realize it's like, wow, there's a lot that could be done here.
Yeah.
Just a supermarket.
Right.
Walk into a supermarket and it looks so extravagant.
One thing that I remember going to a talk after Peace Corps of a friend of mine who had been in Gabon. And Gabon is a world different from Guatemala, where I was a Peace Corps volunteer. And most of Guatemalan volunteers have running water and electricity. Frankly, creature comforts. Even by the time I finished, I had a cell phone. She shared a story of how when they first got paper towels in the community, that the ladies would take the paper towels and lay them out on the bushes outside of the house, the shrubs, to dry them and reuse them. And they would reuse paper towels until they fell apart.
Yes.
And now, and she shared how, and this has never left my mind, when she walked into the airport to come home, she walked into JFK, and in the bathroom, it was like, three towels, three crumples, and right into the trash, right? Mm-hmm. And that simple extravagance that we are afforded is lost on 99% of civilization.
Yeah.
Well, of modern sort of advanced civilization, right? Like the folks that enjoy a hand-waved towel dispenser can't comprehend the idea. They literally can't comprehend the idea that you would dry it and reuse it.
Yeah, I think one of the most unique features of humans besides opposable thumbs is kind of an infinite ability to take things for granted.
That's the quote of the episode right there already. Kurt is on a roll. I love it. So one of the things that I read that really fascinated me about the way that you put into perspective the work that you're doing, and I think I'll direct this to Andy, is this idea of helping your customers grow their wallet. So can you help me understand why that particularly is the focus?
I think when people think about providing power to communities that are beyond the grid, I don't know how it became the norm to think that solar lanterns would solve the problem.
It would be enough.
Yeah, that would be enough. But I think for me and for what we're doing at AMPT, growing your wallet was immediately something, it just in talking with customers, that really was actually much more exciting to them.
Yeah.
So they'd be like, oh, you know, I say, how do you like your lantern? How do you like this and that? And they said, oh, you know, can you give me something where I could make money? Like they have a hunger. Every home isn't really a home. As I'm sure you're aware, it can become a business so easily if you just have the right thing, like, and they'll create anything into a business. And so imagine if you can give them a freezer or you can give them a maize grinder or something, they'll be selling to all their friends.
That's right.
But growing your wallet was really that concept of, you know, give somebody the ability to earn income and that they want that much and have that hunger much more than, oh, give me handouts or give me. And I think one of the problems that the sector faced early on with solar lighting is it's a consumable and you don't want necessarily people to be paying for like a luxury when they're making that trade-off for school fees.
Yeah.
Or something else that's equally important. And I think as a company, we're very cognizant of like, yes, people need lighting, but you want to be able to give them an income so they're able to not only have a solar appliance, but earn much more for their families beyond that.
Yeah, it's what they'll ask for if you talk to them all over the place, Central America, Africa. What do you want? Well, you know, thank you for handing me this nice toy, but I need to make money.
That's right.
And you do that with kind of appliances, you know. Yeah. In fact, I remember reading a story about in World War II when all the women would go to the factories because all the men were off fighting. The thing that enabled that was like washing machines and stuff. Because washing clothes, if you see people in Guatemala beating them on, is huge drudgery.
Yeah.
And just the appliances like that to enable people to do something much more interesting than clothes washing is critically important.
On Suncast, my job is to connect you with the thought leaders, the original thinkers that understand how the industry has evolved and is evolving. That's why next Wednesday, April 24th, I'm hosting a live conversation with Brian Giglia, the Director of Business Development at REC Group, and Brian Lynch, the Director of Policy at REC Group. Both are senior leaders in the solar industry for the last two decades. They've ridden the ups and the downs, and they deeply understand the tactics, the strategies that work and win in any market, and in particular, the residential sector. So if that sounds like something you'd be interested in, if you've been pummeled by high interest rates, restricted by state level policies, well, I have an hour's worth of insight that you'll want to tap into. How to adapt to those policy changes, how to find financial solutions for your homeowners, and more next Wednesday, April 24th at 3 p.m. Eastern. You could register by going to mysuncast.com and clicking on the register for the next live broadcast button. Couldn't be any simpler. I'll see you next Wednesday.
I was thinking about this on the flight over because as I read more about the work that you're doing and the focus on appliances, we, as you rightly pointed out, we overlook that a blender is an appliance. We don't consider even, in many cases, like the refrigerator, probably the thing that we walk by and open the most in the house, right? It's a life-giving appliance.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The ability to keep things cold, generally speaking.
To buy larger portions and preserve them.
Yeah. Right. I had neighbors that didn't have refrigerators. They relied on buying fresh food every single meal. Every meal, fresh food. The thing that I started thinking back, like, well, how does an appliance, like a blender, in my neighborhood, and this is not something you see much in the United States, but you see it all over the rest of the developing world, right? Is as soon as someone has a few extra dollars, they'll buy something that can help them create something their neighbors need. A licuado, a smoothie, right? In my neighborhood was one of the more popular things, or they would set up a little pop-up, either tortilleria, like making tortillas, or making food, generally speaking, is one of the more common ways. And it's not something where they'll go out and get a permit and open a storefront. They'll build an extra room or use an extra room on their home. They'll open the window and they'll sell into the street.
And it's much more of a barterer thing.
That's right.
Like, we're doing favors for you. You're doing different favors back and forth. It's much more like that.
Yeah. I was having a conversation with my children about how money came about, right?
Right. Started as a barter.
Yeah, exactly. It started as a barter and we needed a way to actually provide more value than what someone could physically trade, you know, pelts or gold or silk or whatever it was.
It's hard to trade like a fifth of a goat kind of a
thing. Yeah. and it's hard to create micro components of that currency, so to speak. In one specific way, I was impacted in thinking about how the differentiation of where we are in what we call the developed world and the underdeveloped nations or developing nations is what we colloquially refer to as the Industrial Revolution. So I wanted to read something and have you respond to it. Because you said, We're filling in these missing rungs, hiding a productive use power center inside a solar home system that is super expandable. Our work is a means to the end of empowering poor families to be more productive and grow their incomes. What does it mean in that context to replay the Industrial Revolution?
Well, you can't start at the top and work down. So that, and you know, if you take that approach, like the millennial villages and stuff, it doesn't really work. It has to be supportable from a ground up. And frankly, it has to be supportable from a corporate standpoint, because people always get exhausted from giving money. And when you go that way too, you actually lose kind of the chlorine in the waiting pool, you know, weeding out the dumb stuff.
Right.
Because, you know, if you're just handed money, you can do whatever dumb thing forever. And so, but people, you have to kind of climb back. You can take advantage of the fact that you have a lot more knowledge about what works, but you really need to be able to give people a lower end thing. So you can't start with, you know, tractor trailers or even dump trucks. You have to start with a little three-wheeled. You start with a nice wheelbarrow. Mm. And then maybe you can motorize that thing or turn it into one of these little three-wheel things. That's the approach that people get to grow with.
Yeah.
When Andy and I started, in fact, we wanted to do productive use is the buzzword for
yeah.
it. We really wanted to focus on that, like 300 watts on up, because that can be a blender, you know.
Yeah.
That can be a lot of
300 watts
things.
Of power.
300 watts yeah. of power. You can run a power tool or charge
yeah.
one.
Yeah.
Which makes more sense in yeah. the developing world setting. And we looked out there and it's like, there's not enough. The market just isn't there yet.
Yeah.
It's getting there.
Yep.
In fact, you use the example of TV growth. You know, we started out with like 18-inch TVs, became 22, 24,
right.
30. They more, you know, people, once they have it, they mm-hmm. want the next larger size.
It occurs to me as well, this concept that I'd never really focused on, that the differentiation of the industrialized versus pre-industrialized countries is access to motorized equipment.
Yeah.
Right?
Motorized is the big thing.
Right? Yeah.
And here, because it has a Silicon Valley mindset, people are like, what kind of cool app would people really like to use? It's like, until you give them these other things, they're not going to be that interested in,
yeah.
in neat apps.
Well, we're talking about providing what is essentially, you call it a home power system. My understanding of it is this hybrid of an inverter and like a UPS, uninterruptible power supply for the home that is modular. But at its core, it is capturing electrons through solar panels, delivering those electrons to either direct current devices like lights.
They're more efficient, yeah.
Which are highly efficient because there's no efficiency loss in conversion. Or storing that power for use later. But many of us who have been watching sort of how the subcontinent, in particular in Africa, has developed with Pico and Microsolar, would likely consider that market is pretty saturated.
It is.
Right? And so I guess the question is, it's the question I asked Andy when I first met you. Like, you're both highly degreed and even pedigreed Stanford alum that could do anything with those degrees and your careers. And this is, as I understand, I don't know, fifth or sixth or seventh company for you, Kurt. It's, you know, number maybe four or five in your career as well in terms of step, Andy.
Number one.
Is number one. Well, the underlying question is, with an engineering degree and international experience and loads of accolades to your credit, why focus on what, on the surface, seems like a saturated market?
Well, it's not.
Yeah, the part that we're working on is completely not.
Yeah, providing power to people is not saturated. In fact, a lot of the people that are developing Pico solar systems, they don't expand well. They don't embiggen very easily.
Embiggen.
Well,
it's
often said around here.
That's good.
Engineering, right. And so it's not. In fact, that was my basic pitch to Andy when I first, I said, nobody's really focusing on what people are asking for. It's the dumbest thing in the world. It's like, they want this.
Mm.
So they need power to do useful things.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk to people about hand tools and stuff. What do they use now?
Yep.
Hands. That's all they can use is hand tools. And, you know, if they just had like an impact driver or a drill that they could use, they could, you know, build so much faster. They could fix cars so much faster. But it's like an impossible thing when the power is seldom on, too expensive.
Yeah. Just one other thing. While the solar lighting space is very saturated, we very consciously, like even, and our products are here on the wall behind you, including the solar generator, and we're sitting on our solar freezers. But one of the things we were really conscientious about is even though we're making, our kits start with a very small lighting base, it can expand massively. But then we sort of quickly outgrew that segment and have more recently been focused on what we call productive use, and in particular refrigeration.
Yeah.
And just to give a sense on refrigeration and how big and open that market is there's only 17% penetration across urban and rural areas. And
of refrigeration?
2 to 4% in rural areas in sub-Saharan Africa.
Wow.
And so what we found, which is a refreshing new opportunity for us, is there is no competition. The biggest competitors we've faced so far are $1,500 to $2,000 solutions, mm-hmm. which, I mean, think about even for us, if we, that would be expensive if I wanted to buy a fridge.
Yes.
Like, how could a shopkeeper in rural Africa afford that?
Mm.
Whereas our solution, even at the second half of this year, is half that cost.
Wow.
And that's, you know, at pretty low volume still, but growing.
Yeah.
And so I think for the potential, and also in general, like what's out there on the solar freezer front, you'll actually only find fridges in general.
Yeah.
You won't even find ones that are very powerful. And so we feel like it's
can't freeze.
Right.
Just don't have enough horsepower.
Right. Pretty untapped in general for the productive use segment, which is very exciting.
Yeah.
It's like anything you do will have a huge impact. And like the engineering we apply is just really appreciated by people. They can tell right away that, wow, this is an amazing product. It cools down to zero within half an hour. Like nothing does that.
We're going to unpack the engineering, because it's just the way that you guys have gone about engineering, re-engineering products like a television blows my mind. But for folks to, I want folks to really get a sense of what you're displacing, because we talk in the U.S. a lot about, and there's a lot of lip service in particular to decarbonizing the grid, right? But in the U.S., that's what we have to decarbonize, is a centralized power generation system. In Africa, there's no centralized power generation system. We're decarbonizing life. The alternative is some sort of liquid fuel source turning a reciprocating engine, right?
Yes.
It's a traditional generator.
And a bad one at that, because the affordable ones are pretty poor.
Yeah.
Think blue smoke.
Can you put into context then, and I recall that you had some numbers around just the country of Nigeria, how many generators you need to be offsetting on an annual basis, and what's the average cost of that generator? And let's just sort of put numbers around this for folks to wrap their head around.
Probably 8 times the national grid capacity in Nigeria is powered by fuel generators.
Right.
So I think in terms of the potential to offset, it's huge. Right now, most of it is run by backup generators.
Right.
And over 70% of the population has less than 9 hours of power a day. I think that's really good to keep in mind in terms of like...
And that's better than 5 years ago, which was less than like 6 hours of electricity a day.
And when I started working on in the sector, and I'm sure Kurt has even more interesting figures, but 15 years ago when I was working in Sri Lanka, a solar lighting kit cost the same as our 100-liter freezer.
Oh my gosh.
And so the rate at which things are accelerating and the level of access that will be possible over the next year and the next 5 years, it's also, you can't really comprehend it.
Yep.
But still, I would say, like, if someone were to buy our solar fridge and they could afford it up front, hands down, it's lower cost than the fuel generator approach.
Right.
One of the challenges we face is that a fuel generator is low cost up front.
Right.
And it basically has that stretched out financing because you're paying for fuel. But if you calculate over even a year, it's more expensive.
Oh, yeah. If you use it a lot, it's like $1,000 in fuel. You're $200.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we've had access to, which has changed the game, is this facility from the European Development Finance Institution, which allows us to provide 6 to 9 months of financing from the date of landing in, say, Nigeria.
That's amazing.
And that then you can match or even undercut the cost of a fuel generator. And no matter how brilliant we engineer our products, you know, you have to innovate on all fronts: logistics, your import duties, how you're handling your HS codes, the product, and, you know, frankly, the financing. Otherwise, you're not going to beat the fuel generator, which is exactly what we want to beat.
Yeah. You know, a lot of folks want to talk about payback. And obviously, if you're financing these systems, one of the reasons is you're trying to get to or assimilate what they are experiencing in their day-to-day cash flow. And a payback on the generator is different from the payback on the upfront cost of a 10-year or 20-year life cycle generator. How do you contextualize that for customers in Africa, this idea of payback or being sort of having equal value?
Well, I can tell you how you don't do it. You don't try to do it with a spreadsheet and an actuarial argument of, yeah. You know, because that's not going to work. What you try to do, and this is where PAYGO becomes so important,
and our
financing, mm-hmm. pay as you go, right? That you really need to spread it out so you can make it be the same, the same monthly cost.
Right.
And then you get to say, this is roughly the same cost. And after a year or
it's
two,
free.
Short, you just own it. Now
right.
it costs you nothing. Right. So it's rent to own kind of argument.
People really don't like the perpetual lease model, which some in our sector have tried. Sort of 10-year lease, that does not resonate with end users.
No.
People like ownership.
Yeah.
And if it's on that 1-year horizon, even 18 months, you can wrap your head around that and it's the same cost.
Yeah, the other argument that doesn't work is decarbonization. That's an argument that we like to use and talk about and fret about.
Yeah.
You can't use that on them.
Nope.
It's like my carbon footprint is 20 times theirs anyway.
Just to get there.
They don't need the lecture from me.
Yeah, you use more carbon footprint just to get there.
Yeah, that's right.
One thing in our favor, though, a recent trend is that people do like to, in places like Nigeria and everywhere in the world, I mean, frankly, I do the same thing as like if you have a big panel on your house, that's a status symbol.
Sure.
Yeah. So the fact that it's silent and not noisy and polluting.
Have you tried putting a Gucci label on it?
Right. People like to show off. It's kind of, it's funny when you know, everybody likes to show off their bling bling kind of stuff. And so, there is a market for making things, you know, with nice ID well. Nice.
It reminds me actually early on when we were like, the first company to really start to push into TVs when a lot of the big players were like, people don't want to spend on these things. If you make something nice, even someone who has a limited budget will spend for something they really want, which...
And they usually have, you know, they'll talk to all their relatives and their friends and they'll kind of pool money together. They have money.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they have a way to get a pile of money.
Yeah.
But they are exquisitely risk averse, too. So they really want you to provide a warranty. They want to trust you because risk is deadly when you screw up. You know, I just spent all my money on this.
And they've been taking advantage of.
Now I can't afford fuel.
Yeah.
Now I have no power.
Right.
Or I can't afford, you know, to send my kid to school because I waste all my money on your dumb thing that broke in 2 months.
Mm.
So it's there's a lot of that.
I'm laughing about it, but this is real for millions of people. I mean, I remember our friend Richard Hansen down in Soluz in Honduras, like for the last 30 years has been working with the UN and many other agencies to both, you know, offer for sale and donated systems in Honduras. And he says that almost 100% of the systems that get donated fall into disrepair within a year or disappear within a year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? On the black market so that someone can have cash today that didn't cost them anything yesterday.
Partly why when Kurt is designing something and we're thinking about it, like it's always designed for repairability.
Yeah. I heard that everything on your product can be repaired for under $15.
Yeah.
The replaceable parts are, and it has to be able to be repaired with just like a screwdriver. You can't say, well, get your, you know, precision soldering iron. No, you can't.
I wish I had it. All of our boards are about this size.
Yeah.
Kurt has a knack for designing things with about a quarter the components of most people because he fundamentally understands the design from the ground up. So he's not, a lot of engineers you meet will put a cookie cutter design together. They'll get an app note for a USB. They'll get an app note for a switcher.
Yeah.
And then it'll turn into circuit soup.
Yeah.
And that's how you end up with hundreds of components.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt, you look at a board and you're like, how is it doing everything it's doing? And one of our investors is Schneider Electric and their team, which is a market cap of $116 billion. Their engineering team looked at our boards and they were like, wait, how is this thing doing what it's doing?
Right.
And that also makes it hard to hack.
Yeah.
Easy to maintain, but the most important thing is repairability.
Super important.
Yeah. So I want to get into a little of the backstory. You mentioned Sri Lanka earlier. It was your first foray into microgrids. You were doing gasification throughout Eurasia. Talk a bit about your early career and post-Stanford or even at Stanford considering where you were going to focus the engineering mindset that you've been honing?
Yeah, so I had a chance to take a year off between my junior and senior year, and I really wanted to do something with engineering and related to a global market, based on actually my parents had worked a lot globally, and so I decided on Sri Lanka, and that's because I actually did a project in high school with Light Up the World.
Oh, yeah.
And no, that's right. Who Kurt also
in
worked
India.
With.
Yeah. You were in high school for that?
Yeah, with their Canadian.
Junior in high school.
Oh, okay. I remember working on that one at Stanford, Light Up the World.
The problem was I didn't know any engineering. During that year, I worked on biomass gasifiers, which was a totally different approach to what we do at AMPT in that, and I think the AMPT approach has a lot better ability to scale since at this Lanka gasifier company, which I was working for, we deployed 7 gasifiers. Each of them was like 10 to 20 kilowatts and served a village, which is fantastic. But every single gasification unit also was different. And so the servicing was a nightmare. You had to think of servicing each one. And Kurt also actually worked on mini grids, but we both sort of in the end
settled. At the same time, I was doing a power meter for Husk.
Yeah.
Husk, yeah, in India.
How about that?
Yeah.
But I think we both came to the conclusion that it makes a lot more sense to empower people. Like, you can always wait for the grid, or you can always wait for a mini grid to come in. But if you can take action today on like solving your problem, I find something very powerful in that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really cool that AMP can provide something that anybody can afford, and
totally.
Like you can solve your problem as an individual, which is scalable, much more scalable.
Kurt, to hear Andy say it, you're a bit of a legend at Stanford, and I
wouldn't go that far.
And I know you wouldn't go that far, so I'm going to let Andy tell it, and then you can fill in the gaps. How's that?
Andy, all right.
Andy, why is Kurt...
Hey, tell me about me.
Yeah, why is Kurt a bit of a legend in the design world, at least from an engineering perspective?
You're going to share this with me, right?
Absolutely, you'll get to...
I'm going to play it back every day for motivational purposes.
I mentioned earlier that a lot of engineers do that AppNode approach. I think... One thing you don't find is like people who are able to design from the ground up for affordability. And that means a lot of things. Like while he is able to design with very few components, he's also always thinking about repairability, reliability, and like the cost to repair a unit in rural Africa is more than sometimes the unit.
Yeah.
And so you have to be thinking about all the weird ways in which people are going to break it. And he's had that in his career.
Yeah.
So like the benefit that I get like working with him at AMP now, he's a whole career of people using things weirdly in Africa and breaking it. And he has all these tricks up his sleeve in terms of how to make sure to do it in the right way.
Yeah.
Well, I can guess about half the ways.
Yeah.
You know, they come up with more creative ways to break it that I don't anticipate, but at least I can get some of them.
Kurt, how did you get into designing for affordability and how does that factor into your work at Stanford?
Accidentally. What it was Stanford, a Stanford group called Design for Extreme Affordability, which focuses on helping design things for, you know, developing nations.
Right.
They got in contact with a group that I was working with doing small scale LED flashlights at the time called LRI. And they contacted the president of that company and said, can you please help us?
Yeah.
And he aimed at me because I did all their engineering. I said, all right, they're around the corner from me. Nice. And so I went over there and started guest lecturing for this class and coaching various groups because the students there, they have book knowledge, but they waste a lot of time on art of the film and whatnot kind of stuff with that liberal artsy fartsy type stuff.
So my brother tells me too, he's a Cal Poly alum. He's like, those Stanford kids don't know squat. Much more practical engineering school.
And so I was like, all right, let me just help you. Let me just do this. Yeah. All right, let me do this part, the circuit part, and help out with that to get groups going. Because that was really, you know, you needed somebody with a little bit of experience than starting green, your first design to be something that has to be ultra reliable and effective and thinkable.
What informed the experience that you brought to the table there? Where did that come from?
I've always had the approach of simplicity and starting from first principles. And when I started with that, one of the first groups that, this was when it was brand new, Design for Extreme Affordability, they were supporting Light Up the World. And that was like a pedal generator. It's not the right way to do it at all. When you want to harness extra energy for people, don't make the person be the generator.
Be the worker, you know, yeah.
Treadle pumps and pedal, that's an aside, but it's a bad idea. You need to harness like extra energy. And I remember looking at it and going, why is this so hard? I mean, you know, this is not that hard for engineering.
Right.
Why aren't all these problems solved? It's difficult. It's all what I call high-hanging fruit.
You
it's
won't
a difficult
get the,
market. How do I get into Gabon?
The Samsungs and the...
That's right.
Why would they go into this market?
Yeah. They might go in later once you've proved it, you know, proved out the market. Yeah. But they're not going to lead with that because they can't figure out how they'll make money. And the tyranny of, I just have to optimize making money... I'm not going to go on a capital. I don't have a manifesto, but it is an unfortunate part of capital. It's always just pushing the lever towards just make money to hell with anything else. Mm-hmm. And I got sick of it. I got sick of working, you know, the next faster Ethernet car. Right. I don't care.
What was your career experience prior to that?
I started out doing weapon systems
for
Raytheon and MITRE and doing like, you know, triple secret.
He did a 180.
I did all. And I went, this stuff's a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
And so I got out of it. Then I was doing stuff that I found intellectually interesting, which is I worked for companies doing embedded control type stuff. I've done power electronics.
Yeah.
I generally get bored with whatever I'm doing. And so then I move on to the next thing to try to learn more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've worked on digitizing microscopes and LED lights and motor control things and autopilots.
And you've worked in all different industries too.
I have, right. Mm-hmm. So I've had a peripatetic kind of career wandering about. It's a good word.
It's a good word. My friend Chris Nelder uses that word a lot.
Right. And I really gelled on this one because it's one of those things where it's like, I think I can make a difference here.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem like there's anybody else serious, you know, working on it. There could be.
Yeah.
There's tons of extremely capable engineers around here. But most of them prefer to make, you know, $300,000 a year working for Meta, making the next great 3D goggles, whatever. It wasn't what interested me.
Are either of you from a family of entrepreneurs?
My mom is an architect, but one of the things, I was born in Austria and my dad was studying computer science, and my mom is actually from Hawaii and moved to Austria in an age where there was like no real internet. It's a longer story, but they lived together in Austria, had two kids, my brother and myself, and then moved. They were like, where should we move where both of us can have a career? And that is sort of in between Hawaii and Austria. And they ended up in California.
Hmm.
My mom, in her own right, is a brilliant entrepreneur because she was an architect, but she would take stock options for some of her
in
pay.
In the company as well.
Yeah. And she was often moving businesses from one lab to another.
It's very interesting that you characterize that as entrepreneurship, right? I mean, it really is. It's carrying risk.
Yeah. And she had her own architecture firm. And then my dad worked at one startup after the next and then ended up being part of Ariba, which was really successful.
Yeah.
And ended up, both of them retired early when I was in high school, which meant that we did a lot of traveling in emerging markets.
Right.
As they were trying to like figure out what they wanted to do with their wealth. In particular, like they were interested in both bringing their business expertise and acumen to social entrepreneurs and helping them grow. And so they started several business institutions. They also have started an impact investing group called Tonic, and it goes on, and they are definitely workaholics and rubbed off on me as well.
But yeah.
It's fun being around that energy, and it's also fun to have parents where, like, if you're having a business problem, you can talk to them about it, and they're excited to weigh in or give advice.
Very cool.
My mom was a nurse. My dad was a contractor building houses and stuff, which
very
was useful training
earlier,
but not really entrepreneurial.
No?
Either one. No.
Did he work for others as a contractor?
He did
himself?
It first. And then he worked, you know, for himself. And so I learned a lot.
I know what you mean. My dad's a general contractor.
Right,
and I don't think he even considered himself an entrepreneur, even though he was.
Yeah. My dad was for the
time. My granddad was a farmer, and he didn't consider himself an entrepreneur, even though he was.
Neither one of my parents
You have to be very innovative.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do.
Yeah, neither one of my parents were really nerdy, but they were like, well, nerdy seems to be okay, so we'll encourage him. So they were very supportive.
As we enter into a new era of grid parity, lowering LCOE cost on commercial solar projects has never been more critical. Recently, Trina Solar's TopCon 700-watt Vertex N module was awarded a bankability report by UL Solutions, proving exactly 5.8% reduction in LCOE compared to other N-type modules. Just one more reason Trina Solar is your trusted partner for total solar solutions. Visit mysuncast.com/Trina to see how a Trina Solar Vertex module can save you money today. Hey, pardon the interruption, but I wanted to just let you know how much of an impact you have on Suncast. Yeah, you. Thank you for clicking play. Without you, this show is just me shouting into the void. But there's still people who don't even know about Suncast. I know. I can hardly believe it myself. But that's where you can help me yet again. There's a simple way that you can show some love and help others discover the show. If you cruise over to www.ratethispodcast.com/suncast, I'd love it if you would leave a 5-star rating and enthusiastic review. That's possibly the single kindest thing that you could do for me today. So if the show has helped, inspired, or even entertained you at all, I'd love it if you would head over to ratethispodcast.com/suncast and give me a virtual 2 thumbs up. All right, back to today's episode. So I can't tell if you guys came together over archery or cocktails with rad conversations. And
she doesn't drink. I met you at Stanford. You were judging Stanford bases, and you were. She's always been what I call, same as me, hovering around this space. Like, it's always like a bug light. You know, it's like, this is really interesting to do something that's social.
It's the early spark in her career, right? It's a thing that she can't not. She keeps. It's the center of gravity.
But once we met, we did continue. Archery was the, you correctly identified archery as the anchor of like why we would keep getting together, even though, you know,
did you meet at like an archery thing? Or did you just call Kurt up and you're like, hey, let's go shoot some arrows?
Kurt is really into archery.
Yeah?
To begin with.
I mean, how does it, I don't have anyone that I regularly go like shoot.
You want to?
Things with, I would love to actually next time I'm in town.
Yeah, all
my kids are into archery, and I learned archery as a youth, but
pretty good as an engineering hobby.
Yeah, because they're compound bows, so they're complicated things. Yeah. And so I became an expert on how to like replace the strings and stuff, which means I watched a few YouTube videos tried it myself.
At least three.
And the way everybody becomes experts.
And
these days,
built the balancers.
We built our own carbon fiber balancers with tungsten weights
to make it like. It still didn't make it like really easy, but it made it a lot easier.
Sure.
And also Kurt taught me very early on in doing archery a very important engineering trick, which is the arrows are carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. And if every time you shoot, you should always bend the arrow because if there's a micro nick, you'll basically, the whole thing.
So every time you shoot into the ground or something, they're crazy strong. Yeah. These carbon fiber arrows, crazy strong. Until you nick them, then they're crazy weak.
And so one time after shooting, I just, as intuition, I started bending it and it broke. And someone looked over at us and was like, what did you just do?
You went, ah! Yeah, it surprised me.
Everyone should do that.
Amazing. But noted.
I learned to use checklists because I'm a pilot.
Checklists.
Yeah.
I was like, chuckless arrows. I got to learn this tool.
And so I got, whenever
you're a
it's
pilot
important.
As well. Okay.
Yeah. And so checklists are really the key thing that pilots use to not make dumb mistakes.
Entrepreneurs, too.
It's a good idea to use checklists.
I say it all the time. Like, is there an SOP for this? Is there a checklist for this? Right. Now, of course, I'm neither an engineer nor a very good entrepreneur, so my checklists are foisted on others. But I believe in the value of them and having them around. It's like having smart people around. I believe that it's important to have them.
Think you remember everything.
That's right.
The checklist, turn that thing on.
You
need the wheels down to land. It's a good thing I checked twice.
There's no way I would have gotten to 700 interviews without a checklist. That's for sure.
I think when you're talking about scaling anything up, you need a lot of checklists.
It's true. Well, talking about scaling, you also have to build a team around this idea at some point. And it's difficult enough to get something to product market fit or to revenue, but then to find the right people and to take something from the bench to the field is an incredibly complex task. Can you talk a bit about that process of getting the team on board? Where do you start? Feel free to brag about the incredible talent that you surround yourselves with?
Well, one of the reasons we've surrounded ourselves with people like that is it's a little bit self-filtering.
Yeah.
It's not, we're not the highest paying thing in the valley here. Yeah. That's probably not a shock to you. It's hard work. Mm-hmm. So it's, it's playing tennis with like a really tall net kind of, if you will. And so the people, if you've got people willing to work here, you kind of know that they're motivated by the same sort of things. It's a little bit self-filtering.
Yeah.
And so I find most people, if you inspire them a little bit with like, this is what we're doing, and it counts. And Andy and I are not the types to, pay ourselves huge amounts. We're not like Elon saying, we need a $55 billion, package, and all you little people get to work for 10 bucks an hour. Neither one of us is... has like an oak desk where we sit and like issue orders. We're all like frontline kind of
we
in the trenches.
The toilets too.
We're out there soldering and testing, with everybody. So we're not too proud to quote get our hands dirty.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been very fortunate with our team is that I think everybody that joins with us and your friend being one of the more recent ones, are jazzed about what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
It's interesting to try to, do something meaningful.
I think another thing besides just having an amazing staff that really care about what we're doing, we have an ability to bring in people from our networks from where we've worked in the past who are experts in their own right. Oftentimes it may be like Ju Ames who came from Diodes. And she like literally was sort of about to retire, but she wanted to give back. And she's like in the heart of Diodes. So she knows how to get us like the best capacitor prices, the best all Diodes component prices when everybody else is in stock out.
I love it.
So we have like these wins. Kurt and his partner is also part of circuit sourcing industry. And so we get the first insights in terms of,
what's going
on?
Is
there going to be a MOSFET famine? Okay, buy MOSFETs ahead of time. But I would say that is rare that you can get that caliber of people, and it's kind of through the people we know, and that is special.
Yeah.
That's
whenever she'll ask me, like, what price do you need? I'm like, what price are you selling it to Tesla for? Give me that price.
Right.
And
that's amazing.
Right, that's tricky to do.
And you've structured the organization as you refer to, a half charity, public benefit corporation.
Right, because we're not fully focused on just go make money, and that's so hard to get, to get off of that paradigm.
Sure.
And to be able to say, look, our real focus is we need to make money so we sustain ourselves. Mm-hmm. But we're really trying to have the most impact we can for the people that really matter.
I mean, I think it's also really true. And like, if you just even think about the refrigeration market, there being only 17% access currently, like one of our distributors also said, whoever can make an affordable, rugged, and high-performance freezer has a billion-dollar market ahead of them. Yes. And we even have some distributors who have tried 18 brands. I kid you not. 18 brands, and they have...
That's a lot of disappointment.
That is.
Only two brands actually made it through and lasted for 3 years.
Right.
So the opportunity to make a better product in this segment, I do think there would be huge financial reward for whoever can crack it. And I think we have a huge head start because we've already done 2 years of R&D and already launched it.
The thing that I want to talk about is specifically R&D. I read somewhere, Kurt, that you said we took all the products on the market, or maybe you did, Andy, and we tore them down and we challenged ourselves to make something better. So can you step me through that process of R&D and maybe start with a thing that really impressed me? It was like, why a television, right? And how did you make a television better, and how does it even apply to the model that you're working on? But really, take us through the lens of the R&D that you go through to break a product down and make it better.
I would even call it like reluctant R&D, okay, which is to say we don't design anything if we can find something out there that's pretty good.
Sure.
Like if we can't improve it significantly, why? Yep. These other groups, they've got it developed, they've got it debugged, they've got economies of scale. Come on, we shouldn't get into it. So why did we get into TVs? And part of the answer is we sort of didn't. A lot of the TV is a standard kind of TV design, but we grabbed a couple of critical pieces.
Okay.
And I'll drill down to some boring but important engineering details. Yeah. One of the things is that people tend to wreck TVs by directly plugging them into solar. because the TVs can handle 14 volts and solar is like 22.
And why wouldn't you? It's a solar TV.
It's got the right plug. So that happens a lot. The other one is if you want to sell a TV on a pay-go system and it's just an ordinary TV, what's to stop people from walking away with that most expensive element of your system?
Yes.
And so we wanted to lock it down. And so we can do that with kind of a power line interface that we developed so that if you don't jiggle the line the right way, the TV won't function. But the non-functioning
part minimal engineering.
Is actually the LED strip. So we did two things with that. When you make an ordinary TV, most companies try to make the cheapest thing possible.
Yeah.
And that's fine, for instance, for you, mm-hmm. because your power is super cheap, 10, 20 cents a kilowatt hour. You know, poor people pay more for everything. It's one of the reasons they stay poor. It's really expensive to be poor.
Right.
And who cares if your TV draws 20 watts instead of 15?
Right.
But when it's solar power charging a battery, really that's all really precious.
Yeah.
And so we put in the best LEDs we could instead of the whatever cheap ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then we controlled those for brightness. And we did some things like as the battery goes down, it tails out.
Yeah.
So it gets dimmer, but that doesn't just go, you know, it doesn't just turn off.
Mm-hmm.
And so by building in those key features and the board that we added to it is this little tiny board just to control that and to listen to the unlock signal and protect the TV. Again, the number one thing is protect it.
Yeah.
Reliability.
Know? Yeah, reliability.
One of the crazy things we ended up engineering is early on when people use the product, because of the whole AC thing, that an AC TV, you can have varying power consumption and nobody will care.
Yeah.
And so, but when we initially launched our TV, we didn't realize all the things like the transmissivity of the screen or other things that affected the power consumption, even though our power efficiency was leagues beyond an AC TV or even the best DC TV, which actually is also how we got into it. We thought all the Global Leap Award winners were bad.
Yeah.
And that we didn't like the fact that if you looked at a solar TV in the sun, you couldn't even see it because it was so dim. But we actually on the line, on the manufacturing line, had to implement a special software routine wherein we controlled the brightness and the ultimately the power consumption of each one so that, because neighbors were complaining like, theirs runs a lot longer than mine. And so amongst the sales in like Senegal, people would, like runtime is king or queen. And so basically they wanted that on the manufacturing line, we controlled the exact power consumption. So we have the tightest power consumption across all our TVs of any supplier.
Wow.
It's a strange thing to optimize
That's
around.
That's amazing.
But we've learned weird things like that.
Were there other experiments you tried or assumptions you challenged that in the end create differentiation for you in the market that stand out for you or maybe even stand out for your distributors or your partners?
TVs and specific
just generally. Go product. Freezer.
Oh, lots of things. So, for instance, on the freezer that you're sitting on.
Yes. This one specifically.
We literally had to argue with our suppliers about how much of a compressor we wanted, how much power.
Yeah.
Right. So, for instance, one of the points you made earlier was that, you know, you get solar, maybe you use it during the day, maybe later. No, you almost always use it later because during the day you have a job.
Yes.
And so you're actually using very little power in that. That's why when there is AC power, that's generally when it's on for poor communities, is in the middle of the day when...
Yeah.
Nobody's around to use it. So one of the big advantages of a fridge is that you have a different way to store power. You can store it as cold. And so you are running the solar when the sun's out because it's the only time it runs.
Right.
But instead of charging a battery, which is expensive, batteries are expensive, you charge ice.
Yes.
You make ice.
Yeah. This is
that's really cheap.
It's worked at scale in buildings in New York City.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And so that was one of our key things to focus on. But to do that,
you
need a bigger engine.
Yeah.
Because you have to do all your work while running the sun, while the
sun
is out.
Yeah.
And so we needed a huge, relatively huge compressor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, dude, you're like twice as big a compressor as you need. That was our first thing. We're now going sort of 50% larger than that one, than twice.
Customer
so
feedback.
We're up to 3X. Well, more.
Yeah.
And that differential cost, just a bigger compressor, is not that much. So one of the things that's been true recently for sort of the last 5 years, 10 years, is that solar's become really cheap.
Yes.
Really cheap. But that's just the first part of it. The rest of it, which the fancy word is balance of system cost,
mm-hmm.
you know, how are you storing it, how are you, you know, making sure you don't over undercharge batteries and run your appliance, all that stuff is the expensive part, not the solar.
Yeah.
So 400 watts a panel, not that much.
For any of the geeks that are out there, we won't go too deep into the technical side, but they're using LiFePO batteries. So you can call up and ask all about the LifePo, but obviously you're in hot environments in Africa, so lithium iron phosphate.
It has to last. They're also intrinsically much safer.
Yep.
Than lithium, much less fire prone. That's right. So you don't have the problem, what I'll call the New York scooter problem, which is that they burn down a couple of houses a day and now they're going to like thoroughly regulate all these things. Why? Because cheap.
Yeah.
You know, they're importing a lot of low cost things that don't have very effective, you know, battery insulation and battery management systems.
Well, you touched on something earlier around affordability and the ability to finance these. And we'll get into that in a minute. But one of the ways that you can, I'll say, control the, that you can have control over the devices as they're being paid off is the system that was introduced to Africa years ago, a decade ago, called PAYGO, pay as you go. And what I think is novel about the way that you approached it, and I want to understand the philosophy around it, is that you didn't go use what is existing. You created your own PAYGO system and in fact made it open source. Can you talk about that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of stemmed from frustration that why should this thing that's easy for us to host on Amazon for $10 a month be expensive? And so we ended up, it's actually
private equity ruins everything.
Well, and charging, I mean, it's kind of like that old, you know, free is not a different price. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Just not having to charge people. And we're like, this is such a simple thing.
Sure.
It reminded me of when like text messages used to cost like 25
right?
cents a message.
Yes.
It's like, what? What are you talking about? This is like tiny amounts of bytes.
I think another frustration is that you're already creating like a transactional overhead or transactional burden. And so make that as frictionless as possible or just reduce the barriers to that.
Yeah.
I think another annoyance with the PAYGO industry as a whole is that a lot of people used it to layer over expensive products.
Right.
And then we're saying that it's affordable, which is completely
because
not the case. And you still need product innovation to lower the cost.
Right.
I think it's just a fallacy to think like, oh, it's PAYGO, now it's affordable.
Yeah. So why open source?
The industry need to go there.
Yeah.
Like, that shouldn't be
make
the barrier.
Make it cheaper
to
for people. We're not trying to find other ways to gouge people. Yeah. Right. Let's only charge people what we have to charge them.
And innovate on the things that matter.
Did you piss some people off?
Probably.
You're doing it.
The people who wanted to make money off of it.
Yeah, that's right.
And we actually literally had a customer in here last week who said how frustrated they were with it being this sort of ivory tower and so happy that there's open source.
Nice.
Right.
I love that.
That is more than us, by the way. But
So that's at least one way that you have, one thing you have in common with Elon.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I don't know. He's not really open source.
Okay. We could have a whole other conversation.
We could have an Elon conversation.
Yeah, we could have an Elon conversation. We could have a bad tech and solar conversation. I think I could stay
John
here
Oliver
until...
saying he's like apartheid Willy Wonka.
Oh my God, I love John Oliver. He
best
nailed
quote
it.
About,
I think John Oliver's the only person to really get under Elon's skin in a long time. It's been really good. Well, I had a question that... on the surface seems, well, it's obvious because it's in all of the branding. But as I look around the showroom, everything says, wow, solar.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What does wow mean?
So
wow.
Early on, we made like a list of product names. And actually, it's Lauren who came up with Amped Innovation. We were on a car drive and brainstorming lots of different, and she's like, rattle off everything related to power electronics and solar, and then it fell out of the conversation. Then wow, we wanted to have a product name different from the company name in case we wanted multiple product lines.
Sure.
It just give us flexibility. And so we wrote down a list of them. We tried them in all of our different countries, and wow was universally the one that everyone could pronounce.
Easy to say, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Everyone could understand the meaning. And so it was just immediately, okay, this is the name. It was like so easy.
How do you engage with the customer? You have made a decision from a business model perspective to be B2B, use distributors, rather than B2C, which is the prevalent model over the last 15 years. So A, I'd love to understand that decision specifically, B2B versus B2C, and how then you engage with and get feedback from customers in that process. Because it seems like you have a very thorough process of getting customer feedback to improve the products.
Yeah, part of it was be a little bit humble and focus on your strengths. And my strengths are engineering, and my strengths are not, you know, marketing things in Senegal. and whatnot. So we wanted to lean on the people that were already there, you know, building that experience. It's no small thing to sell and support products in places like that. And also you have to understand, you know, not like most Americans think like Africa is a country, but it's something like 63 countries or 50. There's a huge number of countries in Africa, and they're all quite a bit different.
They are.
And have different rules and different wants depending on, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, you know, East versus West, all the rest of it. And so we wanted just a different layer there and to allow us to focus on what we're good at rather than trying to build out a whole ecosystem to do all of it. It's interesting because in the United States, it used to be more like B2C, you know, people with Fuller Brushman or selling, you know, encyclopedias. You remember when that was a thing? Door to door. And now, of course, in mature markets, people specialize. People make stuff and then they sell it to Walmart or Target, pretty much, or Amazon. It's really just those three, you know. And that's the approach is more of the specialization. And so we wanted to focus on that. And that way we're more flexible about, you know, white labeling stuff for other people, more flexible about, you know, quicker for us to get into other countries where you already have an established base. We don't make as much money because, you know, we're not grabbing more of that supply chain.
I think a really important dynamic that was happening when we started Amped and something that was really exciting is, whereas previously, or what had come before Amped, were a lot of expat groups that were being completely vertically integrated. We didn't want to repeat that model, like someone had already tried it. And we saw this huge, exciting new wave of local entrepreneurs who were building their own distribution companies and were locally run and locally operated. And we wanted to also tap into that because we know that ultimately, energy access has to be solved by those in the regions where they are. And so as part of that transition, like, we could provide, you know, really great products and get feedback from them, but we also felt like part of, like, energy access and energy transition has to be, like, people who are locally in these places building up companies and building jobs locally. So, and then in terms of the product feedback, one of the things Kurt likes to say is, like, everyone loves designing products. And that's a beautiful thing. Like, everyone will give you feedback about new features and stuff. So we never found that we're, like, too far removed. In fact, one of the things is we have local agents that do after sale service. And that's the really key part of...
And those are your employees?
Yes.
Okay.
The feedback loop.
So customer service is in-house?
Yes.
Okay.
Sort of.
Like, we work with the distributors, but we will send our people there to look at, like, where did these go wrong?
Like a third line of
defense. How do you decide who you're going to work with?
For the distributors?
Sure. However it is that you get your product to market. How do you decide who's going to, who cuts mustard, so to speak?
We have a band process. So part of our sales is budget, authority, need, and timeline.
Yeah.
So for every order, actually, not even just every customer, every order has to pass that, just because we're working with distributors for whom inflation suddenly hits.
Yeah.
The government had a coup.
Sure, yeah, it's real.
The currency, the Naira just crashed. It can change week to week. So one of the things we had to put in place when we got the EDFI facility, this sort of $6 million financing note, was a really thorough credit process. And so we actually have a credit scheme that we've come up with, and I would say it sets us apart, and it's, like, really essential and so easy to go out of business if you don't have that working in the markets we work in.
Since you brought in the microfinance element, how do you solve that particular piece? There have been maybe hundreds of variations on how to finance or create microfinance solutions specifically for solar products and LED light solutions. Is it on a country-by-country basis for you? Or how do you go about thinking about the financing product specifically that essentially helps you get this product in their hands at an equivalent or better price than the alternative, which is some sort of fuel generator?
One thing we found is that microfinance institutions are actually allergic to providing product service and, like, dealing with the hardware. What they do well is being a bank and providing the loan. And so something that's been really beautiful is, like, combining strengths. So it takes our distribution partner, usually microfinance, bank, and Amped working together. And each person brings their strength. Like, I don't want to neither of us want to be in the field, like assessing someone's creditworthiness.
Yeah. And is that a, local product or is it something that is regional, multinational?
It's all over the place. But I mean, a lot of these components have multinational support.
Yeah.
For their programs. And so, we go wherever we can get reliable financing. And
I heard you mention a collateralized ag loan. I'd never heard of that before. Can you talk about what that is? I just think it's an interesting tidbit.
To give you an example of something that I didn't anticipate at all was when we sell one of these systems, they get locked down. When it gets paid off, there's a token through the PAYGO, which you issue, which is unlocked forever. Mm-hmm. Now it's yours.
Yeah.
And we got requested
a token. Is that on blockchain?
To relock it.
No. Okay.
Yeah. And so it's
requested to relock it.
I'm like, relock it? Why would you relock it? And
they paid off the asset. Why would
What do you mean relock it? But the point is they need collateral for other things. Let's say fertilizer. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't PAYGO fertilizer.
Seeds.
Put a chip in it or something. Yeah. Seeds. So you need to use something else.
Okay.
And the only way you can collateralize it is to hold it hostage with PAYGO.
I'll
use that term.
Literally, you can turn off the television. You can turn off the...
So you can turn it back on. And when people harvest their crops and pay off, then they return. I'm going to unlock your thing again. I'm
like, interesting.
Okay, we can add that. And because we're flexible in a small group, we can add it and screen it and throw it out there right away. But that was a good example of a quirky request came from elsewhere. Yeah.
Andy, you mentioned in a conversation that we had when I was kind of trying to wrap my head around the price differential, your goal was to be able to offer something extraordinarily cheap that was previously expensive, right? Like $500 you offer at $85 in the marketplace. But problem.
Yeah, we usually don't make it that far. But
but it's a big delta. And I presume that a problem, especially in a world where they do ascribe value to luxury items and high-priced items, is this seed of doubt that low price equals low quality. How do you overcome that from a messaging perspective?
Yeah, I actually think it's one of, and I remember this is one of the questions on your list, but like, what are some mistakes you made early on?
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake to sell something on price only.
Yes.
And that applies to every single market. Like, you have to have a product that has value. And while everything we do is the lowest price it could possibly be, the performance is the thing that usually hooks people on the sale. Like the fact that the TV is bright in a room and they can see it as opposed, it's like an immediate sale. You see another solar TV in ours is, you can see it during the day.
Yeah.
With the freezer, it's nothing can pull down to 0 degrees in 30 minutes.
We have a quickie test that we invented, which is,
this is cute.
A wet napkin. Take a wet paper towel, throw it in there, fire the thing up, and then talk to people for 20 minutes and open it up. And is it crinkly and frozen?
Yeah.
That's super quick.
That is.
Yeah. Sort of every other fridge out there can't.
Very visible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think even though we really internally focus on affordability and it's really important, I think we learned that it shouldn't be the way that you lead.
What would you consider the hardest won victories so far in the business?
You go first.
I think
deciding who goes first.
There's a lot of battles.
There's a lot of battles, but I think having a product that we don't wake up at night to support. So we scaled really quickly when we first started the company.
Mm-hmm.
Like we went from 0 to 2 million, and in rural Africa, like having to grow that quickly to support the products, I would frequently like look at my phone and worry about, is my WhatsApp going to go off in the middle of the night? And I never have that happen anymore. So we've reached like a product stability that is really lovely.
That's amazing.
We were too trusting to begin. Like I said, we had problems with panels that weren't very good and bad batteries. And we really needed to do a lot more screening. We kind of have two people over in China now that heavily screen.
Yeah.
Suppliers, so we don't get in trouble.
We don't even think trust but verify. Don't trust and verify.
Yeah. What country in Africa surprised you, and what specifically about it was surprising?
The one that surprised me most recently would have been South Africa.
Okay.
And the reason is that you realize that this arc of getting towards more developed can go the other way, which it has in South Africa. They used to have reliable power.
Yeah.
They now have really unreliable
blackouts,
power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so South Africa has suddenly become a really hot market for us because they're really interested in things like fridges are the number one reason people run generators. because it's the number one appliance that they want. You know, can't afford hundreds of dollars worth of fish, milk, meat,
right,
whatever. You know, it's just, it's really necessary. And if it's hot out, it is Africa, it gets hot. In a lot of places, when you don't have AC, which is hugely energy intensive, it's the only way to get cool is a cold drink, some iced drink. And so it's really a really key foundational technology for people that suddenly we have a lot of interest in South Africa. And the lighting system as well as some of our other products. The one that we got requested for was an electric fence.
Oh, wow. Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of areas where, you know, it's for their homes.
Oh, for the home?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
not for livestock.
Yeah. And so now, but one of the things that's, I'll give you an interesting aside, our system can actually support that.
Yeah,
and the reason it can is not so much that it has huge power out. You don't need huge power out. You need 6 watts, but you need it forever.
Yeah.
You need 6 watts for the whole day or a big chunk of it.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it has a big gas tank, a big battery, and can charge fast. So if you have a big gas tank, you need to be able to charge
pulse every
at 100 to 200 watts. And so, so even there where you're like, I can get away with 5 watts. Not if you have a small SHS system.
Yeah.
And so that enables us to do, I don't know if we are going to do that, but we can certainly do that sort of thing. We can run an energizer is what they call it.
I'm going to throw another question at you, Andy. Can you give me a story of someone that the work that you have taken to developing nations has impacted and why it impacted you?
Yeah, actually recently with the Easy Freeze, we had a thesis that it would help people earn more income, and we knew that it's possible, but it's nice to see it actually come to fruition. So one of the customers in Uganda runs it in his store and he sells cool drinks, but he's able to earn a premium by selling them cold as opposed to warm. And so he actually sells like 5 crates instead of 3 crates, which is something very concrete.
It is.
And he loved it so much that recently we learned about something to robustify on our product, which is he would overfill it and then like sit on it and the hinges broke. So we've over-engineered everything in the product.
But we didn't think about the hinges.
Which are now robustified.
That's amazing.
Because they're going to try to squash it. By the way, they shouldn't do it anyway. So we should tell them that.
That's true.
Make the
inside squishy.
Yeah.
So they can't stop people from doing it. Right?
Padded walls.
Okay. Final question. One of the things that stood out to me when we first met is you said we've done so much on so little for so long that we can do
anything with nothing.
And yet it takes something to make this engine work. Everyone listening have made it this far has been asking themselves the question, but how much money have you raised? You're in Redwood City. Level with me. How much did it take to get this far? And where are you at financially in terms of the raise? I saw a random, I think like it looked like it was a crowd starter thing. Like, can you talk about where you're at in the fundraising process and kind of what you've been able to achieve on the little amount that you have raised?
Yeah. So we've raised $5 million to date. We are very happy with our investment team. I would say every board meeting is...
You've got some incredible investors. Name them. Like, you should name drop here because you've got some unbelievable investors.
But in addition to their name, they're actually an incredible group of people when you sit in a room with them.
Yeah.
So we've got Schneider Electric, which is 100. Not everybody knows them, so they have like $160 billion.
It's hard for most of us market cap.
Not to know.
They're like GM titles. Or something.
Yeah, they bought GE
rather.
That's true. Your listeners
they bought Xantrex. So
nerdy. Yes,
it
exactly.
Fixed Xantrex, I should say. Okay.
That's a nice exit strategy. And then NG, which
also
has
French.
Very French.
Yeah.
Valerie's on our board from Angie.
Amazing.
And then we have a really nice mix of impact investors. So Global Partnerships, Alpha Mundi. For those in the impact investing space, you'll know them. And they Autodesk Foundation, if you guys don't know them in the Bay Area, they do incredible work. We even, as part of the perks of working with them, have gotten... refuse servers. So we run one of our token servers on that.
And you've gotten fellows.
And we've gotten fellows.
Well, we're going to be dumpster divers for equipment and stuff.
Yes. But the fellows program is really cool. It's every year. And Engineers for Change, which is a little bit like Peace Corps, but for engineers.
Yeah.
And we've gotten the most incredible fellows who still track our work.
Yeah, we still stay in touch with them.
That's cool. And the interview with the Finca folks, we'll link to that. was that was tremendous. He was a lot of fun.
I
kept listening to that interview, wanting to hear his story too. So fascinating.
Yeah, we still work with one of our really early partners, which is Bright Life, which is a Finca affiliated microfinance that focuses on solar. And they are gonna, like, with the trajectory, they can sell even 100 easy freeze per month. Because of they're actually the that has the customer that was earning selling five more crates.
Breaking the hinges,
And breaking the hinges. But it's so cool when you have that sort of long-standing relationship with a partner.
So I'm sure folks are going to be fascinated with the story. How could they dig in and learn more about Amped Innovation? How could they connect with you guys?
Sign up on our newsletter. That's a good start.
Fantastic. Where would they find the newsletter?
On our website.
And
what's our website?
www.ampedinnovation.com.
It's a long interview,
where
folks.
And info@ampedinnovation.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a myriad of ways.
So do you want to know something? You're the first ever in almost 700 interviews to say sign up for our newsletter. I just want to commend you for that. I think it always amazes me, of all the many calls to action possible, most people will say they can just find us on LinkedIn. And I love it. Go to, what is it, ampedinnovation.com? And sign up for their newsletter.
Yeah.
That is a great call to action. And on that note, I want to ask...
Invest in us, number one.
And if you do want to invest, then reach out to... We'll link to Lauren so that they can connect with you guys through Lauren.
One thing to note on that point, we do a lot with a little, which you mentioned, but the freezer, as a little quick note, we got funding from Efficiency for Access.
Amazing.
And it was a $180K grant, and it ended up bringing us from R&D to full production.
Yeah. We have to give them some chops. It really carried it.
We've won an additional grant to make a 200-liter version. So that's coming up this year. Stay tuned on the newsletter.
You stay tuned as well. We have been having so much fun here in Redwood City with Kurt and Andy. I'm sure that you have as well, because you made it all the way to the end of this conversation. I want to thank you for that. As I mentioned in the intro, the only non-renewable resource you got is your time. I thank you so much for gifting that to us, and you've paid your attention all the way through. I hope that you'll pay it forward by sharing this episode with someone else. You can find our show notes and all the other ways that you can reach out to the team at mysuncast.com. We give you the episode notes right there. I want to thank our sponsors who help make this show possible each and every week, so that the only thing you have to pay is attention. And you can learn more about them, as well as how you could partner with us to reach thousands of solar warriors and climate champions just like yourself each and every week by going to mysuncast.com/sponsor. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.